the same time, during this period of fitful transition, there was a fellow whose career was to take a different turn. Danny Murtaugh, second baseman, double play and double talk artist, and manager to be. Here's Murtaugh doing a play-by-play of a Pirate game in the twilight of his playing career.
Here comes Ralph Kiner up to the plate. Needless to tell you folks that he's our home run hitter. Here comes the first pitch, and as usual, was high and wide where Ralph can't get to it.
You put it again, Dan.
Lombardi's just sticking his nose in again. Go ahead, Dan.
By golly, Ralph was telling me yesterday he felt a little nervous walking up to that plate, and I asked him, how do you think that pitcher felt? There's another pitch coming down there, and Ralph fouled it behind the plate. I might say that Ralph's been hitting that ball real good this spring. He's hit about 24 over that left field wall, and it's 350.
I just assume he's not hit too many in spring training. Remember, every time he does, and he has a good season with home runs?
Here comes the next pitch up, Bob, and it's a curve ball on the outside corner of the plate. But it was too low, I believe, and he called it a ball. Lon's a pretty good umpire, you know that? Warnke behind that plate.
Gee, if he doesn't know balls and strikes after all those years of pitching, nobody will, huh?
By God, he should know. There's another pitch high and inside. It's 3-1. I don't think the fans like it.
No, it doesn't sound like they like it in that background, does it?
Hear him yelling? By golly. I'll tell you one thing. Here's the only man in baseball hitting and got 7 outfielders. Look at that infield, how they play them. They're all back in the grass. Uh-oh. He fouled that one off for strike 2. His count is now 3 balls and 2 strikes. And the pitcher's still sweating pretty good out there. Well, he won't give him anything good to hit. You can bet that. Here comes the pitch right now. Well, let's see what he's going to do with it. Uh-oh.
Wow.
Base hit, line drive past shortstop. Left fielder, center fielder come up with the ball, and they held him to single.
Well, now that's a masterful bit of description, Daniel.
I thought so.
Danny Murtaugh was a mighty versatile man, as time was to prove. One day in the dark days, we asked Mr. Branch Rickey Sr. what he looked for in a young ball player, and this was his reply.
That's a whale of a question. I might tell you that I have a very competent scout, a boy I've known for many years. He is not versed at all in the technique of positions or instruction to players on the skillful little pleasing plays. Not at all. But he is a productive scout, and he asks himself 3 questions. Can they prospect the chap here in front of him? Can he throw hard, he calls it. And can he run fast? And third, can he hit the ball a fur piece, he calls it. Hmm. Now, if the boy can do those things, if he can run fast and throw hard and has great power at the plate, whether he strikes out or not, those 3 things, it seems to him, to qualify him, and he's produced some very great players over a period of many years. Sometimes he adds another one in conversation, and that is, he asks himself, does he like to play? And that is a significant addition. This incomparable thing of wanting to win, it makes men devote themselves to their weaknesses, and it makes men do more than they can consciously. They're completely obsessed by a desire to excel. And when you get 25 men like that, where nothing matters except victory, they sacrifice whatever it takes in the way of diversions and indulgences of themselves. Everything is subordinated and made secondary to the whole objective course, namely to win, to have a great winning team. Those men are not satisfied with mediocrity. They're not having their eyes glued upon fourth place or third or second. It's a whole lot better to have a youngster who's coming along with a direction in his play that leads to a pennant, although this year he may be only able to put us in fourth place or fifth or what have you, than it is to have players of greater ability just now who will not crystallize into a final club that can win a pennant. They will always keep you in a lower position. Our object in Pittsburgh is to get boys who are going to come at one time into a pennant-winning aggregation.
During those painful rebuilding years, there was one event that propelled Pittsburgh into the national spotlight. Consecutive games for an all-time record. a feat that Ruth, Gehrig, Greenberg, and the other greats never accomplished. The year was 1956, and the dates, May 19th through May 28th. That will be remembered for a long time. Almost forgotten is Ralph Kiner's feat of hitting 8 home runs in 4 consecutive games from September 10th through September 12th, 1947.
In 1958, the Pirates jumped from 8th to 2nd, made a good run at the Milwaukee Pennant Express in September. Some experts picked the Pirates to win the pennant in 1959, but that was the year of disappointment, injuries, slumps, and temporary decline and fall to 4th place. Little Roy Face gave the fans their biggest moments, hanging up all-time pitching records of 17 consecutive games won and the highest winning percentage of .947 with 18 wins and 1 loss, all in relief to stamp him as the greatest all-time reliever. And here is the matter-of-fact way Elroy Face explained his phenomenal success.
Well, Bob, I don't think that every pitcher can pitch the guy the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, each guy has to learn to pitch his own way to each hitter because Vern Law might throw a fastball or Bob Friend might get a guy out on a fastball. And if I throw the fastball, he might hit it out of the ballpark because my delivery is different than theirs. Fastball might not be the same as theirs, and you can't go by that. You have to go learn your own way.
Another Pirate who gave the fans a tremendous moment in that otherwise unhappy 1959 campaign was small-statured Harvey Haddix. All he did was pitch 12 perfect innings of baseball, something no other pitcher ever accomplished. He did it against the champion Milwaukee Braves, and once again with the impossible Pirate ending. Anything that Jim and I have witnessed in this season absolutely at this moment pales into insignificance. And we've had some thumpers. Here's the windup and the 1-2 pitch to Burdett. Foul off to the right out of play. And Burdett has shortened up the grip on that bat and is trying to really hang in there. And don't forget, he also is quite a threat at the long ball. Two men down. Last half of the ninth inning. No score. I can't repeat it enough. The 1-2 pitch.
Stuck him out swinging. Haddix pitches a perfect 9-inning, no hit, no run game. A standing ovation.
Ladies and gentlemen, Harvey Haddix has just become the 7th pitcher in the history of all baseball to pitch a perfect, no hit, no run, 9-inning ball game.
Going into the last of the 13th, Bob Prince summed up what happened to that point.
For the final out of the 9th inning was a strikeout on Lou Burdett. It was the 8th turned in by Haddix, and at that moment, he became the 8th pitcher in all the history of baseball to pitch a perfect no-hit, no-run game. He then went on to get him in the 10th and the 11th and the 12th, retiring 36 in a row and counting the final two outs he had against the Cardinals in his last victory at Forbes Field. He retired 38 men in order before a man got aboard and then only on an error. One out, batter Adcock takes high ball on. Strikes. There isn't anybody right now sicker at this moment than Don Hook, I guarantee you that. He's crushed over this. Here's the pitch. There's a fly ball deep right center. That ball may be on through and over everything. It is gone. Home run. Absolutely fantastic.
Pandemonium reigned. Here's what the umpires eventually decided. Adcock hit the ball over the fence in right center. Mantilla scored. After passing second, Aaron took the shortcut across the pitcher's mound and Adcock passed him on the base paths. Umpire Dascoli ruled that Adcock was out for passing Aaron between second and third. Adcock was given a double, Aaron was returned to second, and Mantilla's run was the only one needed to make the score 1-0 and end the game.
If you tried to write the Pirate story of 1960 before it happened, nobody would have believed it. And it would have been rejected by any Hollywood producer as too fantastic. Utterly impossible. All the hopes and dreams of 35 years and considerably more came true to a degree that defied description and analysis. The only way I know how to say it is how sweet it is. And we had them all away. You could single out the trades by General Manager Joe L. Brown or the perfect handling of players and judgment of Manager Danny Murtaugh, or the dedicated performance of many players to surpass anything they had ever done before. Dick Groat, the captain, beating far more formidable hitters for the National League batting title. Vernon Law winning 20 games for the first time in his career. Don Holt, the Tiger, and his driving will to win. Bob Clemente's fielding and running. Bob Skinner's bombing. Bill Mazeroski's wizardry at second base. Bob Friend's comeback. Elroy Face's coldly calculated relief pitching. The ability of almost anyone to climb off the bench and win a game. Every game produced a different hero. And how about the fans? Well, they plastered Beat 'em Buck stickers on their cars, stores, everywhere. And then there was a song.
Yes, sir, Mr. Prince, there was a song. And I know you're not Bob Hope, and I'm certainly not Bing Crosby, but I think we may be able to give the folks a brief idea. It went like this.
The Bucks are going all the way this year. Beat 'em, Bucks!
Beat 'em, Bucks!
Beat 'em, Bucks is right. Well, the fans never gave up, and neither did those Pirates. The later the inning, the more likely they were to bomb you. They seesawed in and out of first place until July 25th. Then Bob Friend pitched them into the lead to stay, a 4-2 victory over the Cardinals in St. Louis. Finally, on September the 25th, ironically in a losing game in Milwaukee, their first pennant in 33 years as the Cubs knocked off the runner-up Cards 5-0. This was the way Paul Long described the clincher.
1-0. The Pirates lead on the strength of a home run by Bill Mazeroski back in the fifth inning. Otherwise, it's been a real pitching duel between the great left-hander Warren Spahn and the great left-hander also Harvey Haddix. Right now, it's 1-0. The Pirates lead.
They've just won it. It's all over. They've got the report down there, Paul. The Pirates win it.
The Pirates have won.
All over.
The Pirates have won the National League pennant on the basis of the Cardinals losing to the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field. It's all over. And this crowd here knows it. A lot of transistor radios here, and the applause has gone up. Clemente has just singled into center field. He's on first. But somehow, 35,000 crowd. Now they're making the announcement on the loudspeaker. The Cubs have beaten the Cardinals, and the Pirates have won over the National League pennant.
A deeply relieved fellow was President John Galbraith.
Well, it has been a long time, and it's been a rough road, but I feel a little bit that we paid back a little of the debt for the tremendous, tremendous support we've had for 14 years. And that's not now. That's
Bigger.
Back when we had a very
Bigger.
Ordinary ball team. They've been great, and I hope they're as happy about tonight as we are.
It was a day Vice President Tom Johnson will always remember.
It's been great. It's the greatest year I've ever had in baseball, as you can well imagine, and it's just a real thrill, and I know the whole city's thrill.
And Captain Dick Groat, sidelined with a broken wrist, was worried that he might miss the series.
Something I've always wanted to do is play on a pennant winner, and I've said all winter, and I've said over and over again, I want to play on a pennant winner in Pittsburgh. I only hope I can play in the World Series.
The city of Pittsburgh celebrated the Pirates' pennant victory with a gigantic torchlight parade through the Golden Triangle at midnight, sponsored by KDKA-TV and radio and the Chamber of Commerce.
The World Series should have been anticlimactic, but it wasn't. Meanwhile, at a Gus Fan Club luncheon in the Pittsburgh Press Club, manager Danny Murtaugh received the first of many awards. He was inducted into their Hall of Fame. Murtaugh, in accepting the award, told this story.
It got to be one of these knockdown battles. So, finally, I'm talking to one of my pitchers who had me pitching at the ball game that day. I said, look, son, when this other pitcher comes up here, I want you to knock him right off. I want you to knock him down. Pitcher might have to be one of these fellows that is quite well versed in the Bible, and he turned around and he said, remember, Skip, turn the other cheek. So I looked at him, I said, all right, me. I said, I'll turn the other cheek. I said, but if this guy don't get out, is it going to cost you $100? So he looked at me and he says, they that live by the sword shall perish by the sword. That's a true story.
And General Manager Joel Brown paid this tribute to the Pirates and Murtaugh.
The 1960 Pirates have not been successful because we have the greatest collection of all-stars ever assembled. I think that there are a number of reasons that have been made public on certainly more than one occasion by many people that have made this club a successful team to this date, and I know they will continue to be successful. Chet mentioned that I've been on tender hooks, that I'm an ulcer case. Well, I don't have ulcers, but I have a few hooks sticking in me around. But of course, I think that's easily understandable. The winning of a pennant has been my lifetime dream, if you don't mind a personal touch here. And of course, to see a dream come almost to its fruition is something that would make almost anyone believe that it just can't happen. But these various qualities that have been attributed to our ball club have been team spirit, desire, ambition, aggressiveness, intelligence. Those of you who have seen Dan, who saw Danny as a player, and who have seen him as a manager, I think will recognize that those very same qualities are inherent in him. And I think those things in a ball club, while perhaps they are somewhat innate in the individual player, are instilled more than anything else by the manager. I think Danny Murtaugh is not only one of the game's outstanding managers, if not the best, but the most underrated.
One loyal fan, the most loyal of them all, who deserved to see the great day when the pennant arrived, was the late Rosie Rosewell. He, in a sense, represented the spirit that carried the Pirates through. And this is how he expressed it one day back in 1950 when he was honored at Forbes Field.
And the only thing I can say is that my love for Pittsburgh will always be an abiding thing in my heart. And my Buffaloes will always be my ball club, whether they're up in first or last.
They'll be talking about the World Series of 1960 until doomsday. The most impossible Pirate team of all. Three times the Pirates won the World Series in 1909, 1925, and 1960. Each time in seven games, but never in such fashion as the 1960 crew. Newsweek magazine ran pictures of Danny Murtaugh with the heading, Wanted for Piracy. The New York Times' Arthur Daly termed the Pirates Destiny's Darlings. The New York World Telegram and Sun said, if ever a World Series was stolen, this was the one.
The 1960 Yankees hit more home runs than any previous American League team. More than the Yankees' famed Murderer's Row, who clobbered the Pirates four straight in the 27 series. They humiliated the Pirates 16-3, 10-0, and 12-0. Worse indignities than any team ever suffered in the series. The Yankees set new series records with 55 runs scored to the Pirates' 27. 91 hits to the Buccos' 60. But the Pirates had them even at the end of six. And finally whipped the Yankees with their favorite weapon, the home run.
And here's what happened in the seventh and payoff game. The Pirates got off to a quick two-run lead on Rocky Nelson's homer in the first inning. They grabbed two more in the second inning. The Yanks came to life in the fifth with Muth Skowron's home run. Then they piled up four runs in the sixth to lead 5-4. Yogi Berra's home run off the Baron of the bullpen, Roy Face, was the big blast, scoring three runs. The Yankees teed off on Face for two more in the eighth, and it seemed to be all over. But in the last of the eighth, pinch hitter Gino Cimoli singled. Verdon got an infield hit. The ball took a bad hop and struck shortstop Tony Kubek on the Adam's apple. He clutched his throat and collapsed. Then Grote singled to left, scoring Cimoli and making the score 7-5. Skinner was thrown out on an attempted sacrifice bunt. Now listen to Chuck Thompson, NBC's radio voice during the series, who described it this way.
In typical World Series fashion, this one appears to be going right down to the wire. Now Blanchard pumping out the sign to Coates, who wigwags with that glove just a little bit. He wants to see that sign again. Now the Coates is into the move, the 1-2 to Clemente. He swings the ground ball, slowly hit off the first base side, charging the scour. He makes a pickup, there'll be no play, and a run scores. Clemente hit a slow roller down first base way, wide of the bag at first, about
Clemente has driven in the sixth Pirate run. Down to third base goes Grote. Two out. It's the Yankees 7, the Pirates 6. And the batter will be catcher Al Smith. Smith steps in with two down as Pirate runners at first and third. And this ballpark is going crazy. Coach into the set. He throws. Smith takes a strike right down the pipe. And Smitty was giving it a good look. One strike to right-hand batting Al Smith. Clemente hit a little dribbler off the first base side, wide of the bag at first, and legged it out into a base hit. And, of course, Erdman was able to score the sixth run. Now the one-strike pitch coming to Smith. It's high and a ball. One ball, one strike. Opportunity in this ball game, in this inning, which came about on a bad hop that hit Kubek in the throat and knocked him out of the ball game. Now the 1-1 pitch coming out of Al Smith. Here it is. Swing and a miss. Strike two, and he really pulled the trigger. One ball, two strikes to Al Smith, who gave it the big ripple, the Sunday punch, and couldn't find it. The tying run is at third base in the person of Dick Grote. The go-ahead run is out there at first in the person of Roberto Clemente. And now the set, the 1-2 pitch coming to Hal Smith. Coach throws. He started a swing and held back and has taken high for a ball. A check swing and a ball two. 2-2 now. And for just a split second, every move of the Pirate dugout came to a stop on that call up there at the plate. But it was a high pitch and Smith held back on the swing. So the count is 2-2. Coach into the stretch. He sets. And the 2-2 to Smith. He swings a long fly ball deep to left field. I don't know. It might go out of here. It is going, going, going. Forbes Field is at this moment an outdoor insane asylum. We have seen and shared in one of baseball's great moments.
In the top of the ninth, the Yanks tied it up at 9-9. They had scored two runs, KOing Bob Friend, the hard luck pitcher of the series, in a hurry. And Harvey Haddix had trouble putting out the fire. And then, the last of the night, and again, Chuck Thompson.
The last half of the ninth inning. Changes made by the Yankees. McDougal goes to third base. Cletus Boyer moves over to play shortstop. Terry, of course, on the mound will be facing Mazeroski. And to go over that Barra play once again, it was a hard hit drive down the first base side. The Nelson fielded on the first hop and tagged the bag at first. That eliminated Barra. He was out. And then Mantle could have been in a rundown, but it was not the case. He dove back safely to first base. Here's a ball one, too high down to Mazeroski. And the Yankees have tied the game in the top of the ninth inning. Well, a little while ago, when we mentioned that this one, in typical fashion, was going right to the wire, little did we know. Art Ditbar throws. Here's a swing and a high fly ball going deep to left. They do it. Back to the wall goes Barra. It is over the fence. Home run. The Pirates win.
Conducted the locker room interviews.
Beat the Bucks. Can't beat the Bucks, can they? No, sir. I can't beat the Mad Buffaloes. I'll tell you that.
That's for Gino Smalley.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We got them. They broke all the records and we won the game. How about that?
There's a good one. Broke all the records and we won the game.
We won the game. Right here.
Yeah, that's it. Here's the president of the ball club, Mr. John Galbraith. And, Mr. Galbraith,
I just want to ask you one question. Yeah. You asked me. Have we paid our debt to the city, the people of Pittsburgh?
I think you have, and you've given your voice to it, too, haven't you?
Everything I've got.
You wouldn't trade a Kentucky Derby victory for this, John.
You're trying to get me when I'm vulnerable.
And the commissioner of baseball, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ford Frick. Commissioner, without question, one of the most exciting World Series in all time.
Well, this is my 39th, and I never saw a finish like that one, Bob. Never.
Here's Danny Bertie. You Irishman, you did it.
By golly, Bob, what a finish. But we've been doing that all the year, and I think the fans are looking forward to it.
Thank you very much, Dan.
John
Galbraith. And I'll just say thank you to everybody. I hope you fans have enjoyed hearing from these very happy world champion Pittsburgh Pirates.
The headline in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette read, "We had them all the way." And the Pittsburgh Press told it this way: City of Champs flips lid.
There was never anything like the all-night celebration staged in the streets of Pittsburgh. It was VE and VJ Day, the Mardi Gras, and New Year's Eve all rolled into one. The celebrations extended to Addis Ababa and Timbuktu. Those crazy 1960 pirates were indeed the most impossible pirates of them all.